cover your face. It's an altruistic act. Whether you use a scarf, however you do it, cover your mouth and your nose when you go outside. We all have to protect each other by protecting ourselves. Democracy Now! Is working with as few people on site as possible. The majority of our amazing team is working from home. My condolences to our Democracy Now! Fellow, Adriano Contreras, who just lost his beloved uncle, Gilberto Castillo, who was 92 years old. Adriano, our condolences go out to your whole family. All the very best, and to your aunt. Democracy Now! Is produced with Renee Feltz, Mike Burke, Dina Guzder, Libby Rainey, Nermeen Sheikh, Carla Wills, Tammy Warrenoff, Tarina Nadura, Sam Alkoff, Tamari Astudio, John Hamilton, Robbie Karen, Honey Masood, Adriano Contreras, and Maria Tarasena. Our general manager is Julie Crosby. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks so much for joining us.
You are tuned to listener-supported community radio, KBOO Portland.
And now, your daily volunteer-produced community newscast, the KBOO Evening News.
Coming up on the KBOO Evening News, Governor Kate Brown has banned commercial evictions for 90 days. The state employment office has been overwhelmed by calls, and in national news, the CDC has called for face masks to be worn when in public. Good evening. This is the KBOO Evening News for Friday, April 3rd, 2020. I'm Althea Billings. On Wednesday, Oregon Governor Kate Brown issued an executive order banning evictions of businesses that cannot pay rent for the next 90 days. The latest directive follows a similar order the governor gave on March 23rd, which banned residential evictions. That order blocked residential evictions during the viral outbreak. The latest order is meant to protect businesses that have been closed or economically damaged by the coronavirus pandemic. Businesses can qualify for protection from eviction by notifying their landlords within 30 days of their rent payment due date that their business has been impacted by the pandemic. According to the order, documentation can include, quote, proof of loss of income due to any government restrictions imposed to mitigate the spread of COVID-19, unquote. The governor issued her statewide Stay Home, Stay Safe order on March 23rd, which ordered the closure of non-essential businesses such as health clubs and theaters. It also imposed strict social distancing requirements that required bars and restaurants to limit their food service to takeout or delivery only, severely limiting their ability to generate sufficient income to cover costs. The order stated that, quote, without further action, many businesses may face termination of leases or evictions, which could interrupt the provision of necessary goods and services during this emergency and impact the livelihood of Oregonians. According to the state's employment department, over 92,000 Oregonians filed new unemployment claims last week. The number was a 21% increase over the previous week's record of 76,000. Each of these weeks dwarfed the previous record of 20,000 filings, which occurred during the financial collapse of 2008. The two-week total indicates Oregon's unemployment rate may be already over 15%, with analysts predicting it could exceed 20% in the not-too-distant future. Just last month, Oregon's jobless rate was at an all-time low of 3.3%, and many companies were having difficulty filling openings. The loss of jobs is a direct result of the state's Stay Home, Stay Safe order, but the directive appears to be having the desired effect. Oregon's rate of infection and death rate is growing slowly compared to many states. Nationwide, there are over 250,000 confirmed cases of COVID-19, but Oregon still has less than 900. Not surprisingly, the record number of new claims has overwhelmed the employment department. The department's phone banks are swamped by newly laid off workers getting help. The online filing system is still functioning, but the massive number of new claims has dramatically increased the time it takes for those claims to be processed. The Department of Corrections has confirmed Oregon's first positive test result for COVID-19 within the inmate community at Santiam Correctional Institute. Results were received Thursday, and the inmate is being treated at the facility according to the DOC and will soon be moved to a 24-hour care facility. The agency said that an unspecified number of other inmates were being tested, and those awaiting results were being held in respiratory isolation. The Santiam facility houses nearly 500 incarcerated individuals and faces challenges related to the social distancing that is necessary to reduce the risk of spreading coronavirus. Oregon's prison system has been ramping up for the inevitability of close-quarter transmission, with 13 tests administered as of Wednesday at the Santiam facility alone. A staff member at the Oregon State Penitentiary additionally tested positive earlier this week, signaling the urgency needed to address the ongoing pandemic. DOC has suspended visitations in hopes of transmission suppression and has stepped up the testing on other forms of flu in hopes of identifying oncoming cases of illness within the community. The rate of COVID-19 infections among healthcare workers in Oregon and Southwest Washington is accelerating. According to the Oregonian, the number of workers affected has nearly doubled in the last 3 days. It now stands at 57. And although the number is still relatively low, the rate of increase is alarming. Oregon Health and Science University, Providence Healthcare, and Peace Health all announced an increase in the number of affected employees from Monday to Thursday of this week. Kaiser Permanente does not release its numbers, and Legacy Health reported no change from its initial report of 8 infected employees. Area hospitals have reported a shortage of personal protective equipment, often referred to as PPE, including face masks, face shields, gloves, and gowns. Due to the shortage of coronavirus test kits, it is widely assumed that the number of infected healthcare workers is higher than the 57 that have been reported. Some workers may be asymptomatic or have mild cases that they assume is just a cold, but these individuals still pose a risk to both coworkers and patients. Thousands of employees at OHSU are represented by the American Federation of State, County, and Municipal Employees, and the union has been critical of the lack of PPE and insufficient testing of workers at the hospital. The Oregon Nurses Association has said that the shortage of PPE means that hospitals have a moral obligation to test workers for the virus if they request it. ONA spokesperson Kevin Mealy said the failure to test health workers raises the risk that hospitals are, quote, spreading the risk rather than controlling it. In yet another change of direction, the Trump administration has announced that all Americans should wear masks or other face coverings when in public. The Center for Disease Control and Prevention recommended the change due to new concerns about possible infections from people without symptoms, not just coughing and sneezing. White House Coronavirus Response Coordinator Dr. Deborah Brix said that even with masks, Americans need to stay home more and do a better job of social distancing. For more on the coronavirus and the response of the Trump administration, here's KBOO's Jenka Soderberg.
The number of cases of COVID-19 around the globe have surpassed the 1 million mark, with over 55,000 deaths. The fastest growing number of cases are in the U.S., where over 260,000 cases have been reported. 6,803 people have died of the virus in the U.S. The United Nations General Assembly last night passed a resolution calling for international cooperation to contain, mitigate, and defeat the pandemic. The resolution encourages all countries to tackle the crisis by exchanging information, scientific knowledge, and best practices, and by applying the relevant guidelines recommended by the World Health Organization. Meanwhile, in Washington, D.C., Trump's son-in-law, Jared Kushner, sparked confusion this morning at a press conference about the federal response to the coronavirus outbreak in the U.S. Kushner made a spurious claim that the federal stockpile of protective gear and medical equipment is not for the use of the states. The definition of the federal stockpile, however, is to respond to public health emergencies, quote, when state, local, tribal, and territorial responders request federal assistance to support their response efforts, the stockpile ensures that the right medicines and supplies get to those who need them most during an emergency. Kushner also made a claim without evidence that governors have misrepresented the need for medical equipment and gear in their states. The Trump administration has been slow to use the power of the federal government to boost production, instead forcing states to compete with each other and with the federal government itself to buy their own equipment. For KBOO News, this is Jenka Soderberg.
Starting last evening, TriMet announced that no more than 10 to 15 individuals will be allowed to ride a bus at any one time. The ruling will allow 10 individuals, or up to 15 people if some are riding together, such as couples or parents riding with children. Under the new guidelines, if a bus has reached its maximum load, it will not pick up any new passengers until someone on board exits. In addition, some seats will be blocked to ensure adequate rider distancing. The agency has asked the public to stay off of transit unless you're heading to or from an essential job or you're traveling to the grocery store or pharmacy. They also announced that service will be temporarily reduced on MAX, as well as most bus lines, starting April 5th. TriMet said they will try to adjust bus service if buses on some routes are consistently full, but have advised riders to leave extra time for their trips. Riders are also reminded that they are no longer taking cash on buses. Riders wishing to get a hop card can do so at the TriMet ticket office in Pioneer Courthouse Square or by calling 503-238-7433 and one can be mailed to you. Dutch Bros Coffee employees have signaled that they've had enough. Workers at the drive-thru espresso and coffee destinations face direct exposure to the public, putting them at risk for potential COVID-19 infection. Complaints from a Monmouth location cite the level of cleanliness as well as close proximity assumed with co-workers as hazards confronting workers. Since March 25th, a dozen Dutch Bros employees in Oregon have filed complaints with OSHA related to the coronavirus. The Grants Pass-based business has over 35 locations in Oregon, with the majority being drive-thru locations where social distancing remains a challenge in the small confines of a coffee hut. Spokespeople from Dutch Bros said earlier this week, quote, steps are being taken to distance baristas with additional training to show staffing calculators their optimal distancing options. In a statement issued to Willamette Week, Dutch Bros spokespeople said steps are being taken to support social distancing and that guidelines were being taken to implement elevated sanitation measures. The company added that it's working with OSHA to, quote, find effective and actionable ways to navigate this unprecedented time, end quote. While social distancing is important during the coronavirus outbreak, maintaining your social connections is important too. Eric Tegedoff has the story.
The coronavirus crisis is disrupting people's lives, but a few tips can help folks stay healthy while they stay home. Andy Luther is medical director at Jackson Care Connect in Medford. He says physical distancing is important, but Oregonians should maintain their social connections. He says people should connect over the phone or through video chats, and notes that strong relationships are critical for good mental health. Luther also suggests keeping a consistent schedule.
Try to maintain good habits as far as getting adequate sleep, making sure you're getting some exercise, again, while maintaining good physical distancing. It's still considered okay to go on a walk or ride a bicycle as long as you're staying away from other people.
Luther says the extra time people have on their hands could be used to start a new hobby. He adds that folks who are feeling anxious might consider yoga or meditation to clear their minds. Nutrition also is important. The restaurant Laughing Planet, which has locations throughout Oregon, is providing free meals for students who are part of school lunch programs. Laughing Planet CEO Franz Spielvogel says no proof that students are part of a program is necessary. He says the idea is to provide nutritious food in a time when people might be falling back on unhealthy meals.
Not all calories are created equal, right? And so the idea is to do calorie-dense food that's also clean and healthy.
Luther says many medical facilities are able to provide telehealth services for people who need to see a doctor. He adds that if you're feeling sick, it's important to let health professionals know beforehand.
The best thing to do is call your doctor's office. They really don't want people showing up at the doctor's office or the urgent cares or the emergency department unless it's truly an emergency.
For Oregon News Service, I'm Eric Tegedoff.
Thank you.
You are listening to the KBOO Evening News. Stay tuned after this newscast for Counterspin. At 6, it's Rising Up with Sonali. Then at 7, The Struggle with Alyssa Pariah. Tonight's weather will be mostly cloudy with an overnight low of 36. Tomorrow's weather will be cloudy early in the day with rain showers in the afternoon and a high of 53. Today in history, in 1931, the United States of America adopts the Star Spangled Banner as its national anthem. The quote of the day is from American singer and musician Bill Withers. The news of his recent death broke today. He said, quote, "I feel it is healthier to look out at the world through a window rather than a mirror. Otherwise, all you see is yourself and what is behind you." Medical officials say the COVID-19 pandemic has created a critical shortage of blood for transfusions at U.S. hospitals. In response, the FDA has shortened the waiting period for gay and bisexual men to donate blood. Mark Richardson brings us this story from Arizona.
Opponents of a long-time rule limiting gay and bisexual men's ability to donate blood says a change in FDA regulations is welcome, but doesn't go far enough. The ruling shortens the waiting period to donate blood for these groups of men from 1 year to 3 months since their last sexual encounter with another man. Blood banks in Arizona were still enforcing the one-year ban on Thursday and were vague about when they might follow the new rule. Alfonso David, president of the Washington, D.C.-based Human Rights Campaign, says they've worked for years to transform the policy.
The Human Rights Campaign has long advocated for a policy that evaluates donors based on individual risk behaviors of every donor rather than on their identity.
The original ban, instituted at the height of the AIDS scare in the 1980s, prevented any man who engaged in homosexual activity from ever donating blood. The waiting period was shortened to 1 year under the Obama administration. LGBTQ advocates say it's wrong to turn away healthy men who want to donate blood during the nation's critical shortage. Wisconsin Senator Tammy Baldwin calls the one-year rule discriminatory and points out that it wasn't based on science.
It shouldn't have taken a pandemic and the resulting urgent blood shortage to make progress on this issue.
Dr. David Harvey, an infectious diseases researcher at Johns Hopkins University, says he has long been frustrated about regulations based on fear rather than facts.
So I think there was some progress today. I'm glad to see the science is being followed. That is the best way to create public health policy and do away with the prejudicial way that health care has been handled in our country to date.
Officials with Vitalant, an Arizona-based blood supplier, says more than 200 blood drives were canceled across the state in the first weeks of the pandemic. On Thursday, the company said it's revisiting its health questionnaires and would announce any changes to its procedures in the next few days. For Public News Service, I'm Mark Richardson.
In response to public outcry, Amazon has finally decided to take greater steps to protect warehouse workers. The move comes after Amazon faced criticism from legislators, union leaders, and warehouse workers about a lack of protective measures for employees who continue to work during the coronavirus outbreak. Coronavirus has been reported at a number of Amazon facilities around the country, and workers have called for facilities to shut down and be disinfected where those cases have been reported. Employees at an Amazon facility in Staten Island, New York, staged a walkout on Monday, and the company fired Chris Smalls, the employee who organized the protest. On Wednesday, warehouse workers in Romulus, Michigan, walked out. In a message yesterday, Amazon spokesperson Dave Clark said the company will start taking employees' temperatures when they report to work and supply them with face masks. This plan will be implemented across all of Amazon's operations, including its Whole Foods stores in the U.S. and Europe, by early next week. Employees with a fever over 100.4 will be told to go home and will not be permitted to return to work until they've gone 3 days without a fever. The company said it has increased cleaning in warehouses in recent weeks and instituted paid leave for employees who are under quarantine after being exposed to the virus. In the statement, Clark also said that Amazon will conduct audits of the new safety measures it has put in place and use internal camera systems to improve social distancing in its facilities. Pueblo communities in New Mexico are the latest nations to report cases of the coronavirus. With that story and more, here's Antonia Gonzalez with National Native News, the daily newscast dedicated to Indigenous news, issues, and culture.
This is National Native News. I'm Antonia Gonzalez. Some Pueblo communities in New Mexico announced first cases of COVID-19 this week and actions they're taking to address the coronavirus. San Felipe Pueblo declared a state of emergency Tuesday and issued a stay-at-home order as three cases of COVID-19 were confirmed. The Pueblo is closed to outside visitors and a nightly curfew is in place. The Pueblo of Isleta announced its first case and has also adopted a curfew. Leaders have been preparing for the coronavirus since March 13th, according to a letter to community members, and they're ready to provide food and other assistance. Zuni Pueblo announced its first COVID-19 case. The tribe is asking community members to help limit the spread of the coronavirus, but in a radio address earlier this week, Governor Val Pantia said the community is not closed.
I've been kind of hearing is the question of, are we closing our community? We have not done so. And the reason is that we have a lot of people that are coming in from the outside, but again, we have to be really careful that we minimize any contact with people coming in, either vendors or those folks that come in through our community. I did receive a notice from our tarot office and taxation office that they are going to restrict vendors, and those are the ones that are going to be coming from outside the Pueblo of Zuni.
The Pueblo is asking community members to also limit travel. Volunteers in Rapid City, South Dakota, recently delivered traditional herbs to elders for smudging and to make tea to provide some comfort as they're staying at home due to COVID-19. China Lockett has more.
Collins Provost and her family gather plants that are native to the Black Hills and use them for traditional Lakota medicine.
We've used sage, which is pejihota in Lakota. We've used washdemna, which is, I believe, in the English language, bergamot or wild bee balm. We've also used cedar.
When the pandemic started, Provost decided to share her supply with local elders. She packed them up in recycled containers and made deliveries with her sister. When the elderly are isolating themselves for their health, she says the delivery can mean a lot.
A couple of them were worried, so they kind of kept us at the door, which was totally fine. We understand, but from that distance, we were able to give them some info about it. You know, just letting our elders know that they are appreciated, that we are thinking of them, and we want to do our part in helping to keep them safe.
Provost is trying to gather more supplies. She also plans to make face masks for elders. For National Native News, I'm Chyna Lockett in Rapid City.
Many health professionals are raising concerns about mental health during the pandemic. Geriatrician Omar Amir from Mount Sinai Hospital works with the Indian Health Service Rosebud Unit. During self-isolation, he says it's still important to take time to connect with others.
This is a time when you may want to call people who are around you, your neighbors, maybe check in with them. And if you're feeling sad or overwhelmed, particularly if you feel like you may want to harm yourself or things like that, then that's the time really to call your doctor, call even 911 if you're having thoughts like that. The Substance Abuse and Mental Health Services Administration also has a disaster distress helpline where they take calls from people who are having a lot of anxiety that's out of control. So this is something that we'll see more of, and it's important for us to try and be mindful of that starting right now.
Dr. Amir says exercise and taking breaks from media are also good ways to practice self-care. I'm Antonia Gonzalez.
The Democratic National Committee delayed its July convention in Milwaukee until August, but the Wisconsin primary is still scheduled for this Tuesday, and the state hasn't canceled or delayed in-person voting like many other states have done. With more on the story, here's Lily Bulkey with 2020 Talks.
Welcome to 2020 Talks, where we track the 2020 election process.
There's simply no responsible way to schedule a convention a couple months from now in person with thousands of people congregating in one room, unless you just want that room to serve as a petri dish for breeding a disease.
University of Iowa computer science professor Douglas Jones agrees with Democrats' decision to push their July Democratic National Convention back to August 17th, just before the Republican National Convention is set to start on the 24th. but he says both parties need to rethink all their conventions. There are lots of logistics, such as printing deadlines for the November elections, absentee overseas ballots.
Pushing the convention back into August is at the very edge of what's feasible in terms of running the fall election.
DNC officials are discussing ways to scale it back. Though Jones thinks a virtual convention is doable and might be necessary, it would definitely be, quote, weird.
The speeches would all be given from people's basement offices or living room couches or things like that. No, you wouldn't hear any applause.
The Biden campaign and the DNC want an in-person convention if it can be done safely. The Institute for Public Accuracy's Michael Brennan agrees.
If it's transitioned to being like a digital convention, I think that would really hamper the ability for the opposition and that discontent to be voiced to the detriment of the Democrats, really. I think that it's an important part of a lowercase d democratic process.
Former Vice President Joe Biden called for the convention's delay, but thinks an in-person voting option in Wisconsin next week is possible.
I listened to the scientists. A convention having tens of thousands of people in one arena is very different than having people walk into a polling booth with accurate spacing to 6 to 10 feet apart, one at a time going in and have machines scrubbed down.
Vermont Senator Bernie Sanders is urging postponement, but Biden says it's not up to the candidates.
I think you could hold the election as well, dealing with mail-in ballots and same-day registration. I mean, there's a lot of things that can be done. That's for the Wisconsin courts and folks to decide.
Yesterday, a judge did extend the Wisconsin deadline to request absentee ballots, but sided with Governor Tony Evers in not delaying Tuesday's primary. Evers himself issued a month-long stay-at-home order, and many fellow Democrats and voting rights advocates still say in-person options need to be delayed. But there are important reasons not to postpone, according to University of Wisconsin-Madison Professor Barry Burden.
It's not just a presidential primary, it's also an election for a bunch of offices, state Supreme Court and a bunch of local elections. So moving back the timing of the primary would actually affect the ability to put new office holders in place as old office holders are moving out.
And in Wyoming, Alaska, and Hawaii, tomorrow's originally scheduled primaries were converted to vote by mail, so results may take weeks. From Pacifica Network and Public News Service, I'm Lily Bolke. Thanks for listening at pacificanetwork.org and publicnewsservice.org.
Some research shows aerosols from vaping seem to harm pulmonary cells, making those who vape even more susceptible to contracting COVID-19 than smokers. The CDC warns that the risk of severe infection of coronavirus is increased for those who vape. Roz Brown has the story.
It seems obvious, but the Centers for Disease Control has now confirmed that smokers, including those who use e-cigarettes, could experience more severe complications if they contract the new coronavirus. It's well known that smoking increases the risk for respiratory infections, and new research shows those with underlying health conditions who contract COVID-19, including chronic lung disease due to smoking, are more likely to need hospitalization. President of the Campaign for Tobacco-Free Kids, Matthew Myers, says those who have traded cigarettes for vaping should know the risks.
E-cigarette is left, but we know that e-cigarettes compromises your lungs. So if you ever needed a reason to think this was the time to quit, it is now.
The CDC analyzed data from confirmed cases in all 50 states and 4 U.S. territories between mid-February and late March. In addition to smokers and those with chronic lung disease, the CDC says people with diabetes and heart disease may be at increased risk of developing severe complications if they get infected with a coronavirus. The CDC recommends that people with underlying health conditions keep at least a 30-day supply of medication, a 2-week supply of food, and other necessities, and no COVID-19 symptoms. The new recommendations come as experts warn the next 2 weeks could be grim when it comes to U.S. deaths from the coronavirus. Myers says other than social distancing, there's nothing better a smoker could do to protect their health than quit.
People who quit smoking do see an improvement in lung health. They do see a decrease in cardiovascular disease risk. And therefore, there shouldn't be a fatalist notion of this. Quitting now actually can make a difference.
Myers adds that the U.S. has so far seen more patients between the ages of 20 and 55 with severe complications from coronavirus than countries such as China or Italy, but experts have not determined why. For Public News Service, I'm Roz Brown.
You You are listening to the KBOO Evening News for Friday, April 3rd, 2020. This is a volunteer-produced newscast, and we encourage your participation. Call us with your breaking news stories and tips at 503-231-8032. Our remote production team for tonight's newscast is Jeffrey Wade, Jenka Soderberg, Ray Bodwell, and Althea Billings. The producer is Ray Bodwell, and our engineer is Otto. The director of Evening News is Althea Billings. A podcast of this newscast is available on our website at kboo.fm/eveningnews. You are listening to KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM, K282 BH Philomath on 104.3 FM, and K220 HR Hood River on 91.9 FM. I'm Althea Billings. Stay tuned for Counterspin.